So,
this course is within what are we discussing here? The Jewish life cycle. So we talked last week about being born and circumcision and specifically getting named, Jewish names. We spent most of our time last week talking about Jewish names. The next part of the Jewish life cycle I thought I would focus our whole discussion on tonight is the conversion process. Now, the conversion process is really fascinating, but it's a very important thing to discuss, not only for people who may not technically be Jewish and want to become Jewish, but because one way of getting to the core and really understanding what Judaism is all about is by understanding the criteria that someone from the outside needs to follow in order to be part of the club, if you will. Okay, Rabbi Lamb wrote a great book, Maurice Lamb. It's called Becoming a Jew. It's like a big, thick book. If anyone has seen it, it's really well written. And he says about conversion, quote, "It's only by how we define converts that we're able to define our own selves as Jews. And the crisis of who is a Jew, what criteria we set up for conversion, is really a crisis of self-definition. In an ironic twist of history," he says, "converts have become the mirrors of our own souls. Because whatever you tell someone from the outside that you need to do this to be in the religion is basically how we understand the religion. And how is that?" So that's why I think it's a great thing for Jewish people to know about. I also think it's a really important, I said this on Shabbat, that everybody, every born Jew, should have one friend who's converted to Judaism. It keeps you from taking your own Judaism as for granted, as we often do. The truth is, we are really a nation of converts, just like America is a nation of immigrants. Judaism is really a nation of converts, because when did Jews become Jews, actually? What's that? No, I mean the people, the history of our nation, yeah. Right, the Jewish people were actually, were they converted technically? Because how did we really start? How did the Jewish people actually start?
Well, yeah. In Egypt.
Well, even before then, who was the first Jew?
Abraham.
So Abraham was the first Jew, but there was no real religion, if you will. It was more like he founded this, he started believing in God. He then passed on this tradition with his wife Sarah to Isaac. Good. Isaac and Rebekah passed it on to Jacob and his family. They became the 12 tribes. They descended into Egypt and ultimately became enslaved. But what really defined them as Jews at that point? They were called Hebrews, Ivrim, which means they were on the other side. That's what in Hebrew, in Aver, means the other side of the Jordan. We were like a little different. We didn't get the religious component of who we were until when? Until Sinai.
Until Moses took the tablet.
Very good. Until Moses came down from Sinai with the Ten Commandments for the Jewish people, and we got this book called the Torah. Until then, we were, what were we, really? We were this nation, but we didn't have a set of rituals. We had a few mitzvot. Anybody know what mitzvot were already being practiced at that time? What did Abraham do? What a circumcision, good. And of course, the belief in God, which is an important part of the religion. And there were a few other things. The Noahide Code, which is the seven laws of Noah, basic ethics and morality, monotheism, were already in play from the days of Noah. If you believed in God, then you wouldn't murder. And if you believed in God, you wouldn't blaspheme God's name. You would set up a court system, certain basics. But Shabbat, Kashrut, all these other things that we take for granted, they didn't become revealed to the Jewish people until we stood at Sinai and received the Torah. And what else did we do to become Jewish at Sinai? Anybody know the three requirements of becoming Jewish, actually? One is to accept the mitzvot into your life, the commandments. Okay, I'm going to come back to this a little later. And the other one is to immerse oneself in a mikvah, which the entire Jewish populace did before they stood at Sinai, and the men circumcised themselves. They hadn't been circumcised in Egypt. So the Jewish people in mass converted to Judaism. We began as a as a converted nation, if you will. Yeah.
Isn't there a line, forever we stood at Sinai's foot, as much as Shabbat has kept the Jewish, as much as the Jewish people has kept Shabbat, Shabbat has kept the Jewish.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a famous line from the Hebrew poet Achad Am. That's more about Shabbat, how the Shabbat has kind of kept us a people, kept us, you know, but it does, you know, it does demonstrate how important Shabbat is, and Shabbat didn't exist before Sinai. Okay? Now, Rabbi Lamb, in his book, writes that the most often asked question a convert receives, anybody know? If you were a convert, what question would you probably get the most? There you go. Now, sometimes that question is asked out of simple curiosity, and sometimes, usually when it's asked by a Jew, it's asked like, why did you do it? Like, what would it bring you, you know, to do this? Why would you do this? And to which the convert often responds in their own disbelief, like, what do you mean? Don't you realize how amazing this is? Why would you be surprised that somebody would want to join this? You know, don't you realize what a treasure? I mean, there was a woman, I remember she came on our ski retreat a long time ago, and she was German. And she had enrolled herself in a conversion program, and she was coming here. And we were having a conversation, and I asked her the same question. I was like, why did you do this? And you know what her answer was? I'll never forget this. She's like, how many reasons do you want, Rabbi? So I'm like, just give me one. And she said to me, that she grew up Christian, and she said Christianity for her was like an institution. Judaism offered her a personal relationship with God. That was her answer. And there are many different answers that I've heard over the years. But I want to go through, I think, a little misperception, because the Torah's attitude towards conversion is really fascinating, but it's highly misunderstood. First comes first. Just so there's no misunderstandings, Judaism accepts converts. There's no mandate to convert non-Jews. Like, we're not a proselytizing people. You don't see us going out there and trying to make more Jews. And I'm going to talk about why that is, because we're small. Why wouldn't we do that? But we don't. But once it's been ascertained that a convert is sincerely interested in living a full Jewish life, it is considered then one of the 613 commandments to convert such a person. It's considered a great mitzvah to do. And Judaism has absolutely no theological problem with conversion. A lot of people think that we do. Anybody know why? A lot of people think Judaism really doesn't want converts. We kind of say we do, but we really don't.
It's kind of hard.
Because why?
It's kind of hard to convert.
Because it's difficult. And?
Well, I mean, like, we're turned away a few times before a rabbi will accept you, and...
Right. You get a little of the runaround. Now, why do rabbis give potential converts the runaround? Because just to be nasty? what were you going to say? Did you have a suggestion?
I was going to say that it sort of dilutes the...
Well, that's what you would think.
Yeah.
Now, if it's done, again, if it's done authentically, then you don't have to worry about anything getting diluted. But that's the concern, and that's why sometimes there's a little of a runaround. Meaning, we want converts, but we want good converts. What happens if we relax the standards of conversion, which there's, by the way, a lot of pressure to do, from grandpa and grandma who want to see their daughter that just became engaged to, you know, to someone not Jewish. We want to make it a little easier for them. The problem is, you end up redefining what Judaism is. What are we going to say?
That's kind of like what you just said. There's a lot of interfaith couples now. People right. are doing it because right. maybe they're not that religious, right. and their spouse is Jewish. It's important to them. Is that considered a
good. It's a very fair question. There are some people that will not perform conversions if the person is converting for the sake of marriage. There is such an opinion, but there are very highly recognized halachic authorities, and this is the way we have operated here at MGE, because we are highly recognized halachic authorities, that if the person, even though what brought the person to Judaism was not Judaism per se, it was their falling in love with someone else, if the rabbis officiating, presiding over the conversion, believe that this person is nonetheless sincere, even if that's not where it started, but it ended up that this person is serious, this person believes in the tenets of Judaism, this person wants to observe Shabbat and keep kosher and all that, and they really want to do it, then they are embraced like anyone else. And I do think there's a tremendous opportunity of individuals who may not have had such an interest initially, but then come to fall in love with it. However, there are a lot of people who don't have an interest, still want to get the conversion, but are not falling in love with it. And that's the big population that's problematic, and that serves as a tremendous challenge. Yeah.
Well, I think it can really convert people into really, you know, full-on being Jewish. Like, for example, my brother-in-law's father converted to Judaism, mm-hmm. but my brother-in-law got married in, quote, his bar mitzvah talis. So there's an example of, instead of going the other direction, it's from someone who isn't even Jewish, mm-hmm. raising a Jewish son.
Mm-hmm.
So who, someone who wasn't born Jewish.
Right. Basically. Right. The question is, what happens when you get somebody who really is just doing it because to placate some family member, and they're not really sincerely interested in it, and they're just doing it because they want to keep what's called shalom bayis, a little peace in the home. Now, this is very important. The reason we don't missionize, and the reason we're not interested in such an individual, honestly, is philosophically, we simply do not believe that unless a Gentile becomes a Jew, their soul will never be saved. See, Christianity very much believes, and unless you believe and subscribe to a belief in Jesus, that you are doomed to eternal damnation. This is classic Catholicism. I'm not saying every denomination of Christianity is like this, but essentially, there is this belief that to save your soul, you need to become one of us. We don't believe that. Now, we do believe in believing in a one God and having ethics and morality based on that one God, the seven laws of Noah we referred to before. But the Talmud teaches that all righteous Gentiles have a share in the world to come, just like Jewish righteous people. And I've said this to every single person I've had the honor of converting to Judaism. I turn to them right before they enter the waters of the mikveh, and I say, I just want you to know, and I know you've heard this before, but you don't need to do this in order to be loved by God or in order to have a relationship with God. If you do this, it's because you want a Jewish relationship with God. If you do this, it's because you want to keep Shabbat. You want to live by the laws of the Torah. But you don't need to do that to be in favor or to live a life that is positive or still have a relationship with Hashem. You have the seven Noahide laws of ethics and morality, and if you abide by them, you are guaranteed a share in the will to come, just like a Jew who abides by his or her laws, or just more. But it's yeah, please. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to get to it. Okay. I'm going to get to it in a minute. So one of the reasons we don't missionize is because we don't think people need to be Jewish. They can if they want. It's a great merit, but it's not something required, and the individual gets pushed into it. Here's the problem. What's the problem? Just say, okay, just do it anyway. What's the issue?
Insincere.
So it's an insincere, and now you're going to be evaluated according to what standard now? So I always said to one of my kids, like, you know, you're in a certain level class, right? Go into a level class that you're comfortable with. Because if you go into a level class that's like over here and you're here, okay, you're going to be evaluated, the tests are going to be here and not here. And not everybody has to be here. It's not a game of like who can go where. You have to find what works for you. But unfortunately, people are not thinking of the theology. They're thinking about their family. And they're thinking about, oh, it's a shanda. You know, it's like sinful that somebody would be marrying someone who isn't Jewish. And I'm not in favor of that. But, you know, you don't fix the problem by having a sham conversion. You fix the problem either by having a real conversion, falling in love with Judaism, or dissolving the relationship. We've created a new category. Keep the relationship and change the conversion standards so that it works with us. And that unfortunately changes the religion itself. And if you allow that to happen for too long, you end up with something that no longer even resembles Judaism. And that's one of the challenges that were happening. So this is very, very important, though, to understand. Conversion is a very positive thing. Converts themselves, assuming the conversion is authentic, are supposed to be looked up to, welcomed into the community. No less than 36 times in the Torah does it say, thou shalt love the stranger, referring to the convert. The Torah reminds us again and again, ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim, that you were all strangers in the land of Egypt, and when we got out, we had to convert to become Jews. So this is how we all started out. So, what does a conversion entail? You were just asking a moment ago. So, essentially, it's a commitment to become part of the Jewish people and to observe the religious practices. Two parts. Now, why are there two parts? Because there's two aspects of being a Jew. There's the peoplehood notion, and there's the religious part. That's why people get confused. Are you an American? Of course I'm an American. I'm proud to be an American. But being a Jew is also a nationality. Right? Being a Jew is not simply being part of a religion. If you are Catholic, Catholicism or Christianity is not a nationality. You are an Italian Christian. You are a German Protestant. You are a Swiss, whatever, you know, Baptist, whatever it is. Hang on one second. A Jew is joining both a people and a religion. And therefore, when you convert to Judaism, you're accepting both peoplehood and the religious notion. Who was the most famous convert in the Torah, in the Bible? And we actually learn laws from the way she converted to Judaism. And that was Ruth, who converted from, not only from outside the community, but she was a Moabite, a despised nation, an enemy of the Jewish people. And she became a very, very important figure in biblical history. And Ruth, perhaps the greatest convert, said it best. I'm quoting from the book of Ruth. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. She said to her mother-in-law, Naomi. She had married Naomi's son, who was Jewish, and she was not. Her son intermarried. And then her son died. And she could have just gone back. She was a princess from Moab. And instead she clung, the Torah says, to her mother-in-law, Naomi. It's a very beautiful story. And when Naomi said, you're young and beautiful, and you will be, you know, you will be looked down upon if you come back to the Jewish community, and who knows if you'll find a suitable mate, go back to Moab and have a life. But she wanted to be Jewish. And what did she say? Your people will be my people. Your God is my God. That's the peoplehood and the God. Those are the two notions. And we see this in the Code of Jewish Law, where it outlines the very first discussion a rabbi is supposed to have with a potential convert. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says that when a Gentile comes forward and expresses an interest in conversion, the court, in order to ascertain his or her sincerity, should ask the following question, and I quote, why are you interested in this? See, this is where it comes from. Don't you know that the Jews at the present time are persecuted and oppressed? Can you say that today?
Depends where you are, I guess.
Well, what would you say today? I mean, the Shulchan Aruch was written in the 16th century, the Code of Jewish Law. If you were a rabbi today and you were, can you? Of course you can say this. There's still anti-Semitism all over the world. Israel is still being attacked simply because it's a Jewish state. I don't buy the whole political European colonization of the Middle East. It's not true. Jews have always been living there. It's just another excuse, in my opinion, for anti-Semitism. That's my political commentary on the side. So I think you can unfortunately continue to say this. If the convert answers, I know, I'm aware, and I am indeed unworthy, then the court shall accept him. And they move to the next phase. And what is the next phase? By the way, before we get to the next phase, what does this question demonstrate? It demonstrates the peoplehood aspect of conversion, to see yourself as part and parcel of the Jewish people, whether it's for the good or for the bad. And
But he said he's unworthy.
Right. Meaning, that's just a humble way of saying, yes, I know, and I hope you'll accept me still, kind of thing. I want to tell you guys a story, because I'll never forget this. We were a number of years ago in Israel over the summer, and we went to the Hadassah hospital to visit a victim of terror, of a terrorist incident in Jerusalem. And we met this amazing young guy named Keith, who was from Bayonne, New Jersey. He was 20 years old. And he went right into the army. He was like an ardent Zionist. He made Aliyah and he wanted to fight for Israel. And his base was attacked by a group of Palestinian terrorists who dressed up as Israeli soldiers. It was a terrible incident. They killed four Israelis and they wounded a number of others, among them Keith. And someone from our crowd, when he was speaking, it was very inspirational, asked that if he would made Aliyah and join the army, if when he did that, he knew that he'd be shot and injured as he was, would he have done it? You know, like, would you do this all over again? And before he answered, there was another guy who got up from the audience who I did not recognize, was from a different group. And the young gentleman stood up and said, you know, I just realized, some guy from the audience, another American, that the day I converted to Judaism was the day that you, Keith, were injured in that attack. And I know this because when the rabbi was performing the conversion, he asked me if I really wanted to convert to Judaism, since the Jewish people are such a persecuted people. And he said that just today there was an attack on an Israeli army base, Jewish soldiers were killed and injured. You sure you want to be Jewish? And I realize now that the rabbi was talking about you. And then Keith asked the guy, well, what did you answer the rabbi? And the gentleman said, I answered yes, and one day maybe I'll be worthy. And then Keith turned back to the convert and said, welcome to our people. And that's really what it means to be Jewish. It's one aspect. You're joining a people, and it's not necessarily so simple or so easy to be part of the Jewish people. We thankfully had it a lot easier here in America. We maybe can't even relate to this. And so the convert joins our people. He also has to accept the religion. Not so simple. For many, this is the most challenging part of the conversion process. It can take many months. Usually takes between a year and 2 years, depending on how much time or how already initiated, how much learning the person has done in advance. The ability to master or at least have a basic understanding of the laws of Shabbat, of Kashrut, the Jewish holidays, how to read Hebrew, to learn how to pray and feel comfortable in a synagogue. Essentially, the convert needs to demonstrate their knowledge and their ability to live like a Jew. And that's why it's going to vary. Some people can fast track it. You know, if they've got a lot of time on their hands, they're really smart, they're quick learners, or they have some more background. Other people may take much longer because they're not as serious, or they're very distracted with work and other things. But it's essentially, I would say, knowledge slash commitment. And the commitment is probably even more important. Because usually if you're committed to something, you can gain the knowledge. It's just a question of how much you really want it. Now, what are the three rituals involved in converting to Judaism? I mentioned them briefly before. Number one, for men, it's circumcision. And if a man was was circumcised, which often is the case, maybe when he was born, it's a very common procedure. They do what's called the hatafat dam, which is literally a prick of to show a bit of blood. It's more of like almost like a symbolic. It's really nothing, but it is something. But if the person was already circumcised, they wouldn't have to be recircumcised, obviously. Number two and three applies to both men and women. Number two is immersion in a mikvah. Now this is really interesting. Anybody know how you would originally become a Christian?
Yeah, being immersed in a river or something.
Right. The first Christians were Jews who believed Jesus was the Messiah. So in order to become a Christian, back in the days of Jesus himself, his adherents had to first convert to Judaism. When he was trying to gain adherents from the Gentile world, he first had to convert to Judaism and then believe that he was the Messiah. So how do you convert to Judaism? Circumcision, immersion in the mikveh, and acceptance of the mitzvot. To this day, when Christianity wanted to popularize itself, It abandoned the 613 because that is a really bad way to popularize a movement, to have 613 mitzvot. And they popularized the Big Ten. They got rid of circumcision altogether and they kept the mikvah, which is today called
baptism.
Right. That's where it came from. Because that's what it originally meant. So you have immersion in the waters of the mikvah, and then number three, Kabbalat HaMitzvot. You ever heard of that word Kabbalah, which means to receive? Receiving the mitzvot, the formal acceptance of the mitzvot. And these three rituals express the fundamental criteria for conversion, because it's these three rituals that go to the essence of really what it means to be a Jew. Let's go through each one. The Rav said, Rav Soloveitchik wrote, a Jew has two commitments, to observe the mitzvot of the Torah and to identify with the historical destiny of the Jewish people. And when a candidate for conversion appears before the Beit Din to join the Jewish fold, they're asked, A, what motivates you? Don't you realize, we talked about this before, that you're joining a persecuted people? Why would you want this? The second question deals with the acceptance or the discipline of the mitzvot. And Brit Milah, circumcision, is a covenant that binds him. It's a sign of identity with the community of Israel and represents the national commitment to peoplehood. Whereas immersion in the mikvah, which initiates the acceptance of the mitzvot and represents the personal identification and commitment to God and His commandments. And that's essentially the way that we convert. I want to mention one other thing and then open it up for discussion and finish up. The acceptance of the mitzvot, I think, is the hardest. Because basically what you're saying is that I'm going to change my life. And I'm going to start for 24 hours a week, I'm going to keep this thing called Shabbos. And I'm no longer going to partake of eating any food that I used to eat. It's really a metamorphosis, if you will. In fact, the Talmud says when a person converts, they're kakatan shenolad. They're like a child that has been reborn. They become someone else. That's why they get a name, a new name, and they take on literally a new identity. And that's why I feel it's got to be something you want. It can't be something someone's ramming down your throat or guilting you into. Because you either want to live this life and be in a relationship with God, this kind of relationship, or you don't. And that doesn't mean if you decide not to, you don't have to have any relationship with God. Does that mean 99.9% of the world that is not Jewish has no relationship with God? Of course not. That's ridiculous. But if you want this relationship with God, this is how it's done. And the Talmud says that if a convert accepts 612 and rejects one, that the rabbis, the court, cannot accept such an individual. Why? Seems very harsh. Because the person needs to accept the totality of the Jewish lifestyle, even if they're not up, you know, none of us is perfect. Everybody messes up. But ideologically, it can't be like, yeah, this is the part of Judaism I like, I'm going to embrace this part, and this part doesn't, you know, jive with my modern day sensibility, so I'm going to reject that part. Right? That's like taking a recipe and saying, oh, just this, and expecting the, you know, the dish to come out the same. Now, it seems a bit harsh or unfair. I'll tell you what really seems unfair and difficult. And I've had this so many times when people say this to me. And they'll say, Rabbi, I have a friend who's Jewish. He didn't do half of these things. He doesn't keep kosher. He doesn't observe Shabbat. And me, I have to be holier than him or her? This is really nothing new. In most legal systems, this is the case. We talked about John Lennon because this is the day, unfortunately, his life was taken. But most aliens trying to emigrate from another country have to do exactly the same thing. They have to learn things about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and the Constitution, and be a model citizen. Even though their friends who were born here, you know, they're not even voting, they don't know which way is up, they never visited the Capitol before, you know? Because if you want to join something, now no one says you should take your patriotism for granted, you shouldn't. But if you do, you're still an American. But if you're coming in from another country, and you want to become an American, you have to be naturalized. Because you're not that person, and in order to become that, you need to figure out what does it mean to be an American. And that is the kind of lifestyle I have to start living. It's no different with Judaism. And therefore the halakha recognizes religious commitment as the only way to authenticate and to create a Jewish identity. You could be a great person, a great humanitarian, you can even be a great Zionist and philanthropist to Jewish causes. You could have your name on every hospital in the world and give money to the UJA like nobody else's business. But none of that relates to the inner core of what it means to be a Jew. There are important aspects of being Jewish because they show the peoplehood aspect, right? And that's important. But it's the religious practices that also define us, because it was the giving of the Torah that ultimately made us into the people we are. And so even if you fought in the Israeli army and you displayed incredible traits of loyalty and dedication to the Jewish people, or you're from Russia and your passport is stamped Jew and you suffered anti-Semitism because they called you a Jew, but you never really embraced the religious components of your Judaism and you don't have that halachic tradition of being Jewish, then there's something that's still missing. And this is a difficult thing for many people to accept, because we don't look at Judaism as a legal system. We look at it as our religion. And religion in America is just something we either have faith in or we don't. That's not Judaism. Judaism is a way of life. It's a total way of life. It's not a little part of our life. It's the way we look at everything. And that's why a lot of people are very put off by the whole conversion process, because it seems unfair. And it seems to discount other people's feelings towards Judaism and give this kind of like objective, black and white, you know, halachic definition. And I think this is not a simple thing, but the core of Judaism has always been defined by the system of halacha. Halacha, anybody know what that word actually means? It means to walk. The way the Jew walks. And so it stands to reason that a commitment to halacha would be the defining criteria. There was this huge debate in the 1980s, and it's coming up again in the Israeli Knesset. Who is a Jew? Right? Birthright has to figure it out also. How do you know when you can give a free trip to someone? Well, I have a really, my best friend's Jewish, is that good enough? Right? I don't know, how do you define who is a Jew? Right? To determine issues of citizenship, does the modern state of Israel use to determine whether someone's Jewish or not? How about how much money you give to Jewish causes? Should that be the criteria? Or is there something beyond us which is objective and which we believe is rooted not within ourselves, but in God Himself? And that's why we try not to come up with these things ourselves. Because when any one of us comes up with a definition of a Jew, there's by definition a personal bias. And that might work for you, that's great. But it may not work for somebody else. And ultimately, we try to look up for definitions. You and I, we can all come up with what we think Shabbat should be, or what I would determine what animal is kosher and what animal is not kosher. But that, then we're going to have a religion, we're going to have 5 million religions. Not, well, we have 15 million of us in the world. 15 million religions, not one Jewish religion with 15 million adherents. And you really can't have it both ways, and we're trying to do that. Because there are members of the family that are upset, and they come banging on the rabbi's door for a solution. And if the rabbi doesn't change the religion to suit other people's needs, then the rabbi gets accused of being stubborn, closed-minded, intolerant. But all the rabbi is trying to do is maintain the integrity of the Judaism that was begun thousands of years ago. And to the extent that we can do that, we can continue to have a Judaism to latch on to. Once we start playing with that definition, then it's anybody's religion. And I this turns into a very controversial thing, obviously. I'm just babbling at this point. Any questions or comments, please? Yeah.
I just have a question, Jeff.
Yeah. Both. They're both 100% true. Yeah, we get more Nobel Prizes than anyone. And you should know that we were getting Nobel Prizes and winning you know, awards for our scientific discovery as Hitler was planning the concentration camps. They were happening at the same time. I read an amazing biography of Albert Einstein, written by Walter Isaacson, a great biographer. And do you know that when he hit the age of 50, he was the most popular person in Berlin? 1930, 3 years before Hitler rose to power, the city of Berlin bought its most famous citizen a summer home, as an expression of their... So of course, and Hitler used to call all the science that was around at that time Jewish science, because there were so many prominent Jews that were in the forefront of scientific discovery, not only in Germany, throughout Europe. So, unfortunately, you could have them both going on at the same time, where we're being persecuted, and on the other hand, we're being lauded and praised for the great contributions that we make. Yeah, I wish we could sort of subtract one of them, but it seems to somehow be part of our identity. You know? Yes?
I would say I think that's what makes us Jews in America, to have that particular understanding. Like when you said, that it's very different here than over there, because not to discount what you're saying, but we have that almost as like an armchair view, mm-hmm. where we understand the concept of persecution, but not really understand the consequences of persecution.
We've been spared. We've been spared a lot here. What are you going to say?
I was going to actually disagree with that. If you look at many of the institutions of the early 20th century, there's plenty of quotas on Jews. I mean, there was recently an article in the paper comparing, you know, the experience of some Asian Americans nowadays to what Jews experienced in the first half of the 20th century. So, we obviously didn't experience the first.
Right, I guess I'm referring to our generation. But, you know, there's no question, you're 100% right. I mean, the quota system in this country, you don't have to go back that far. In the late 1930s, so many Jewish lives could have been saved. Our whole discussion tonight is all about immigration. What's that? You want to hear the quota from Germany in 1938? For people from Germany, people, it was 21,000, meaning the United States would allow 21,000 people in from Germany in the year of Kristallnacht. Do you know how many visas applications there were from Germany in that year? 220,000, and they didn't even fill the quota. Only 18,000 and something immigrants were permitted in from Germany in that year, and that had everything to do with anti-Semitism. Also, a lot of xenophobia and other kinds and forms of racism were breathing very healthily in those days. So you're right, even in America. I guess I'm speaking a little more about our generation. We're a very privileged generation, you know. Any other questions about the whole conversion thing? Yeah.
Not yet. I was kind of curious about what your thoughts about people, like, I've heard of rabbis kind of going back and questioning the Jewish validity of certain conversions, you know, like, if even though it was like maybe valid at the time, they were kind of questioning, well, this person's not following like all the all the mitzvot, you know, do they take away conversion?
That's a good question. So generally speaking, once a conversion has been done properly, even if that person, that new Jew, falls and, you know, messes up, they just become like the rest of us, bad Jews.
Oh, no.
I'm just kidding. You know, meaning that it's not like, oh, it gets undone. It doesn't become undone. Once you are converted, you are converted. And the fact that you may wane or not, you know, keep it up, it's not a good thing. And that's one of the things a rabbi is supposed to tell someone who's converting to Judaism. See, it's not fair, theologically and spiritually, to a person to say, you know, push them into conversion, and then they're not up for it, and now they're being held to that standard. We talked about that before. Because it's not like it just unravels. Okay, yeah, whatever, it was like a fad. You were into it 5 years ago, you're not into it now, so it's okay, you're not really Jewish, because you're not doing the Jewish thing. No. You're Jewish like the rest of us, you're just not keeping up to it. And then you're evaluated and judged accordingly, and that's not a position we want to put people in. Yeah.
Is a rise in interfaith marriages, mm-hmm. has there been a rise in conversion?
100%, but there's been a rise in authentic conversions. Now, the group that we work with here at MG is called the RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, mm-hmm. They have converted, in the last 5-6 years, about close to 1,000 people just in the New York area. So it is a very robust conversion program. But I will tell you, because I work very closely with them, I'm one of their judges, whatever. You know, they have a 3-panel court, so I serve as one. And it is rigorous, but it is doable, and it is reasonable. And they don't require the people to stand on their heads and do ridiculous things. But it is, it's real, and it demands a certain, you know, adherence to the minutiae of the halachic system. But again, that's why you have to want it. If you want it, it's like falling in love and getting married. It's a lot of work, but it's the kind of work you want to do.
I have 3 Jewish friends whose spouses converted to Judaism.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I have a friend who converted 3 times. He converted Reform, and then he converted Conservative, and then he converted, you know, he's exhausted. But, you know, so sometimes that might happen, because there are different standards. There are different standards. Yes?
That was the question I was going to ask you, like, from the, let's say, Reconstructionist and Reform
right.
side to the, you know, Hasidic and Lubavitch side, where do conversions generally come in, and what are the, and let's say, Conservative and Orthodox, where are the...
I would say the major difference between the two types of conversion out there, without getting into every denominational difference, because I'll keep you here all night, is whether or not a expectation on the part of the court that's performing the conversion, is there an expectation that this person is going to observe the commandments? That's what it comes down to. That's what separates the men from the boys, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are you going to be doing... Now, does that mean the person is going to be perfect? Does that mean everything has to be 100% in play by the time the conversion is done? Not necessarily. But the rabbis have to be able to walk away feeling like, we can convert this person because he or she knows how to live as a Jew and is committed to doing so. There may be problems and issues, and it's not perfect, but what is? There's no such thing as perfection. So I think, for example, the RCA group that I've been working with is quite reasonable. Not easy, but reasonable if you want it. If you don't want it, then it's just going to be, it's not going to be a pleasant experience. And there's no reason to do it. You're not accomplishing anything other than making some parent or, you know, future in-laws, you know, happy. Yeah?
You find that the converted spouse is usually the more observant one?
Usually. Usually. There was a famous scene in a show that I, of course, never watched, but somebody told me. Sex in the City is a very famous thing. And she's starting to learn, right? I read it somewhere.
He wants to watch the game.
Right, he's watching it, and she's like lighting the candles, getting ready for Shabbos, and he's like watching the Met, and she is a great line. She's like, I gave up Jesus, you can give up the Met. Great line. It was very, very funny. So, but that's why I said this in the beginning of the class. It's really important for everybody to have, anyone who's Jewish, to have a friend that is converted to Judaism, because it pushes us to, you know, those veteran Jews of us here, you know, it pushes us to appreciate what we so often take for granted. And that's why it's really a beautiful thing. And to help somebody who's really trying to convert is a huge, huge mitzvah. To actually help someone, because there's a whole social dynamic. People feel on the outside. And even though they may know more than some born Jews, they may even be more committed, but they don't, you know, they didn't go to that Jewish camp like everybody went to, and they don't have all the slang down, and they may not look exactly like, you know. And that's why it's considered a tremendous mitzvah to embrace such a person. And it's a tremendous prohibition to, in any way, be negative and to abuse. Verbal abuse is biblically prohibited in general. Verbal abuse against a convert is singled out for severe penalty in the Torah, because that person feels that much more alienated and alone to begin with. So, and I think, you know, the convert does at least as much for the Jew as the Jew might be helping the potential convert. I think we truly gain truly gain from being with each other. So I personally am very pro. I think it's a beautiful thing. I think we should be embracing individuals, but trying to help bring them into something that's real and authentic, so that they are not held up to some standard that's not fair for them, and that the religion that we so, you know, cherish is not diluted in any way, so that it maintains the integrity it needs to have. So I thank you all for listening. Yeah, one last question, please.
True false.
It's a quick yes no. If a Jewish couple adopts a non-Jewish child, does that child have to convert?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I mentioned this last week, and I'm glad you asked it, actually.
If a Jewish couple adopts a non-Jewish child,
the
child has
the
to
adoption
convert,
in,
Jewish.
Yes, even if the child is raised 100% Jewish, it would be no different than like the immigration. Somebody comes in here, and they're raised in a family, they still have to be naturalized. They still have to go through that. Anybody know how you convert a child? Because what aspect of the, which part of the three that we talked about is missing? Well, circumcision is easy. Not for the kid. But it's easy to do that on a child. Which one? Which of the three? Remember the three requirements? Mikvah, circumcision, and accept. How can a 10-year-old accept? A 10-year-old doesn't have what?
Intellect.
Right. Well, they have the intellect, but they don't have the ability to fully comprehend and therefore accept. Just like in American law, you can't have a child, a guardian has to do it. So how do we do this? Do we convert children? All the time. How do you convert a child? Talmud says that there is a legal principle operating, which is zachen la'adam shelo b'fanav, which means that there's a zechut, the merit. We sort of act in the best interests of the child. That's kind of the term the courts use. That we do something that, and it's considered to act in the best interest of the child. Mitzvot is the best interest. It's the best thing for you, we believe. So therefore, we actually substitute the da'at, the intellectual commitment to the mitzvot for the child, except when the boy hits 13, majority age, and the girl hits 12, which is when she becomes a woman. That's really scary. My 10-year-old is going to be a woman in 2 years. Whatever. They have the opportunity to opt out if they want. And I have a very close friend whose mother converted to Judaism. She converted her two sons at the same time that she was converted. And the two boys, my brother was friendlier with the older one and I was friendlier with the younger one. We used to spend like every Shabbos together. One of them kept going. He became a huge Torah scholar, moved to Israel, and became a great leader in Israel. And the other one decided he didn't want it. And he's not Jewish. You don't have to formally do this. One mitzvah that you keep after your bar mitzvah means that you're going with it. But you could theoretically, at your bar mitzvah, say, I'm not interested in continuing with this. You could theoretically do that. It's rare, but it happened. Yeah.
Where does the born Jew's obligation to perform mitzvot come from? So the convert's obligation comes from consciously entering the covenant. Where does the born Jew, who does not consciously so much enter the covenant, where does that come from?
You're saying because they never chose?
Right. So it comes from
his mother.
Under your parents?
No, his mother. His mother. It flowed from his biology.
Ah, okay.
It's not a cognitive intellectual thing.
Okay.
He was literally born into it.
Okay. But
this is who you are.
But no, I understand that. But so
now you can choose. You have free will.
You're still under an obligation. I don't understand. There's no obligation to perform its vote, is what you're saying. 100%
obligation.
There is obligation.
But that obligation does not flow from a choice that you've made. Now,
okay.
Now I'm speaking theologically.
Right.
Practically, you decide you want to keep Shabbat, you keep Shabbat. You decide you don't want to keep Shabbat, you don't keep Shabbat. But whether you have an obligation or not, that just comes with being a Jew.
Okay.
That's what it means to be a Jew, is that you are commanded in these mitzvot. Now, we consider them a privilege, not a burden.
Right.
And we're trying to show how awesome they are, and therefore why they're worth keeping. But it's not like, maybe this is what you were getting at, it's not like when a bar mitzvah boy gets up and says, I'm going to do it. No, that's the way the child is trained to hopefully want to do it. But they're just born that way. I know, we don't even think of ourselves like that. It's kind of interesting, yeah. Am I cutting into your...
Our office does religion provides structure.
Structure, purpose, and meaning, and the problem is, you know, if you don't grow up with a wonderful version of Judaism, and I don't mean denominationally now, I mean if it wasn't presented in a positive, joyous way, then many of us are kind of turned off by it. Most of our exposure has been to, like, I don't know how Yom Kippur became, like, the most popular Jewish synagogue day. I'm not saying it's not important, Yom Kippur is very important, but most American Jews get Yom Kippur without the Simchas Torah or the Purim. And as a result, they grow up thinking of Judaism as a burden. You know? And if you grew up with it as being part of, you know, an exciting, you know, childhood filled with all these rich Jewish rituals and way of life and thinking, then hopefully it's going to be something you want and pass on to your kids. But it's not, it hasn't exactly been that way. Yeah. Well, last question, and then I want to turn it over. No, it's okay. These are great questions.
This is a really question, just like a comment. Last, because Hanukkah.